It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. More zero-day exploits in Windows 10, a problem with Docker, Google's plan to fix Android, and Steve has the answer to his conundrum from last week, our vending machine problem. All coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 687, recorded Tuesday, October 30th, 2018. Securing the vending machine. Security Now is brought to you by PryLock Security. Teach your employees how to keep your company secure by avoiding phishing emails, candy drops, and social engineering. Show them how and why hackers attack with training from PryLock. Go to PryLock.com/TWiT and use the promo code LEO to save 30%. And by CashFly. Over 95% of CashFly WAF users are running in full blocking mode. Can your WAF say that? Get a free consultation and learn more at securitynow.cashfly.com. And by IT Pro TV, interactive and flexible IT training your team will actually enjoy. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 for 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscriptions. It's time for Security Now. Time to protect yourself and your loved ones online, as we do each week at this time, with this guy right here, Steve Gibson of the Gibson Research Corporation, GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
Yo, Leo. Great to be with you again.
Yeah. You were just up the road a piece.
I was in wine country this morning. Nice. I awoke among the grapes.
Did you have a nice visit?
I did. I've mentioned to you before the geek group that we were it was the MRC, the Math Resource Center gang at my high school. So that was 45 years ago because we were graduating class of 73, and one of our group is sort of a wandering nomad, and he had taken a picture maybe 6 months ago of a group that excluded me. That was our group. And I said, okay, I am never going to miss another opportunity, because it's been 45 years since we've all hung out. And so as it happens, there was an opportunity that came up yesterday. And so I prepared the podcast. I spent all day Sunday working on the podcast, getting it ready for today so that I could take yesterday off, which is normally my podcast prep day. And spend it in the up in Napa. I got there by early afternoon, and we just hung out and caught up on 45 years of all of our shared history, and it was great. So I spent the night, woke up, and flew back down so I could be here in front of my blinky lights.
And it's always nice to sleep in your own bed if you can.
I can't wait. So yeah. Although I do travel with my pillow, because Lori and I joke that I have three feathers in my pillow. It's the limpest pillow you have ever seen.
Hard to get a limp pillow at a hotel these days.
Yeah, everybody's got these foam things, and your neck is all cricked, and you kind of got to get on top of it somehow. It just doesn't work. So
give me feathers.
I travel with a pillow. This is episode 687, and I titled it the answer to our last week's teaser, because, oh my goodness, has our listener audience had fun with this. I mean, I was getting feedback from every available channel, in every orifice, from every venue, and I mean, it was just...
Did anybody get it right?
A couple people did. There was, of course, the inevitable crazy over-engineering where, we got certificates flying in every direction. You got to put a catcher's mitt up when one's flying by and then grab it and then go home and come back. And like, so anyway, we will wind up with a kind of a careful walkthrough of what would be the minimal solution if it weren't for an intriguing problem that the minimal solution has, and then just sort of inch forward a little bit to how to solve that, which then ends up with a really elegant, nice solution. So this podcast is titled Securing the Vending Machine. But of course,
you'll restate the problem before we give the answer.
Yeah, of course. So, of course, lots of other stuff happened. We do have a follow-up from Microsoft on the last week's mentioned Win 10 zip extraction trouble. We got some welcome news from Google and on the Android patching front. Believe it or not, our apparently depressed hacker who goes by the handle Sandbox Escaper.
She's at it again.
Depressed again and has dropped another zero-day surprise on us. We've got a Hadoop-based bot called DemonBot. I also want to follow up a little bit on that U.S. GAO report on the Department of Security. The DOD, lack of security, how distressingly insecure those systems are. There's been some action, it's a bureaucracy, so good luck. But still, I guess nothing happens without some hope. We also have we're going to take a look at the consequences of publicly exposed Docker server APIs, which, you just have to scratch your head. It's like, wait, really? You're saying that Docker service API, there are public exposures? Oh, yes. And so, of course, hackers have jumped on those. Also, I've got some fun DDoS for hire news. We're going to look at the going rate for, in terms of dollars per minute, of purchasing DDoS for hire. If I'm sure none of our listeners would ever blast somebody off the internet, but now we know exactly what it costs. And there's nine different plans you can choose from. The copper, the gold, the VIP, executive plan. So anyway, we got all that. We're also going to check out a midweek Windows non-security bug fix, which, they normally drop a couple days after the second Tuesday of the month, where those are all the security fixes. Then they've got we've also, non-security stuff and lots of stuff there. Large in terms of number, nothing really in terms of breathtaking. Also, Firefox just jumped up to version 63 with some welcome changes that we have forecast previously. I don't think much to see here, new privilege escalation vulnerability, which affects Linux and OpenBSD. We just have to talk about it so that it's covered, but it's not anything that should worry people too much. Well, based on the profile of your system, we've got a little bit of errata. I want to talk a little bit about Peter Hamilton and the salvation sequence, just because what he's done, and there's no spoilers in this. We know I don't do those, but what he's developed is really fun in a Peter Hamilton-ish way. I've got a little bit of closing the loop feedback from a listener, and then we're going to wrap by taking a careful look at this interesting security architecture of a smartphone wanting to be used to purchase things from a vending machine. Of course, last week we talked about how in this particular instance, the app was easily reverse engineered and some white hack gave himself 999 euros, which was probably the maximum number that the app would accept, and it worked. And, of course, he notified the vendor who has taken some action. And so I left it as a puzzler, as our listeners know, for what would be the solution to that. So I think another great podcast for our listeners.
Nice. Should be fun, securing that vending machine. Before we get into that, let's talk about securing your office. Like most companies, have all sorts of hardware protections, intrusion detection, filtering, and all sorts of stuff to protect us. But there's a weak link in every office that you can't do anything about, and that's your employees. Well, wait a minute. Maybe you can with the proper training from PryLock Security. This is such a good idea, and I want you to check this out if you've got a business or even if you have friends or family who are prone to clicking on bad links and getting bit. A little bit of training will go a long way to protect you. It turns out 91% of all successful hacks, and I'm thinking of Sony Pictures Entertainment as a good example, start with a phishing email. In this case, a spear phishing attack, a specific email targeted at employees in a company. If you don't train your employees, they'll get trained by the bad guys, and you will not like the result. PryLock offers a best-of-breed security training platform that will automatically create, enroll, manage, deliver, track, and report your trainings, your phishing tests, your security briefings, and you'll do this for a lot less. In most cases, you'll pay up to 70% less than comparable programs thanks to their really state-of-the-art delivery mechanism. I actually took the training, and I enjoyed it. And then I got, well, I'll tell you, this is so cool what they do. So with PryLock's one-click setup, you could set up a full-year training, whether your company's 50 people or 5,000 people. It doesn't take an IT professional. What you get is a security awareness training. It's kind of like a slide deck with audio that explains how hackers work and actually gets hacked. And at one point in this training, it's so much fun, you get to design your own phishing emails. The whole theory behind this is to teach you how hackers think, what they're going for, what they want, and how they work. And I think that's a much better way to get your employees up to speed on what the threats are and how to avoid them than giving them a set of rules, a do's and don'ts. You know, I'm always saying don't open attachments, you know. But it's more than that. It's really understanding what's going on. And the training's great. It's gamified. It's fun. It's enjoyable. It has, as some compliance mandates require, a 10-question final assessment. But then, by the way, each user gets a custom page. Each employee loaded with resources, things like password managers and stuff, so they can understand and find tools that'll help them be more proactive in protecting your business. But then they do something that's so awesome. I love it. It schedules and runs 24 random phishing tests throughout the year. So before you, after you set it up, they'll do a 3-day baseline phishing test. Like before the training, we're going to send phishing emails and see what your employees do. So you get a baseline for their knowledge. They do the training, and then at random, twice a month on average, 24 times throughout the year, it will send the trainees, your employees, phishing emails designed to target them. And if they bite, oh yeah, the boss sent me this spreadsheet, I better open it, they will then be automatically enrolled in training videos that are, you know, designed around what they fell for, what pitfalls they are, plus emails, reports to it, admins. You get report analytics in real time, 24/7. I think that's such a great idea. And I have to say, I did not fall for the phishing. I feel proud of myself. And your employees will, too. After they take the training, I think 9 times out of 10, they're going to go, because they don't know they're going to get these unless they see this ad. But they will be smart enough not to click, and you're going to like that. If you are an experienced IT pro, you can use their advanced setup at PryLock Security for granular control over key aspects of the phishing campaigns. You can build industry-specific phishing mails, which you'll probably want to do, or use their existing. They have over 600 of the most effective phishing emails out there to con your employees. You get, I think, really good security training. You get testing. You get analytics for you. The tests include open the email, click the links, downloaded attachment, enabled macros, and, of course, the worst level, data entered for credential theft, like what's your login and password? What's your credit card number? Whatever. If they fall for that, you'll know. You know everything that happened from every user, every fish, every click. They'll also learn about other ways hackers hack, social engineering. They'll learn how to answer the phone, what not to say over the phone. They'll learn not to pick up that USB key that they found in the company parking lot. Oh, look, it's a 64-gig USB key. I win the jackpot. No, they call that a candy drop. I didn't know that. 1-year security programs for companies with employees as small as 25 for, get this, $395. You can afford this, and you kind of need to afford this. And this is just for listeners of Security Now. If you are worried about friends and family in your circle, Prilock offers a single license gift card that will test them with two phishing tests a month for a full year. So you can do the training, you can help them, but you can also give them these tests. It's kind of fun. And in fact, when you do the training, you can even design your own spear phishing attacks, that kind of thing. Look, nobody's going to learn all the ways hackers can con and trick you. If you've listened to the show, you know that it's amazing. Their creativity is mind-boggling. But Prilock will teach your employees the psychology they use, and that really makes a difference in keeping you and your business safe. They shouldn't be a victim, nor should you. Learn more. Prilock Security, PRILOCK, like privacy lock. Okay, prilock.com/twit. And we're going to give you 30% off if you use Leo as the promo code, just to get you started. Prilock.com/twit. I've tried a lot of these. I've looked for something like this for our staff. This is the one we found that we love. Prilock.com/twit. Of course, listening to this show, if you get your employees to listen to this show every week, you'd probably be okay. But most employees are not listening to Security Now.
No. So, in fact, when I was catching up with my high school gang in this little informal reunion we had yesterday, I mentioned that I've been doing this podcast. We were in the 13th year, and one of them said, "So, how long is it?" And I said, I think that one of them guessed, like, "Oh, yes, like 15 minutes?" I said, "Oh, no, it's 2 hours." And they said, "2 hours?
Who's going to listen to that?"
I was like, "Nobody does a two-hour podcast." Oh, I said, yes. "Well, in the beginning, it was 20 minutes. And it's sort of gotten out of control." Yeah. So anyway, we have a fun picture of the week. It's been in my library of things to use for the podcast when nothing is particularly apropos for whatever topics we're talking about. Anyway, this shows a robot, kind of a classic robot, androidy kind of robot, sitting in front of a keyboard and screen, looking back over its shoulder at a guy who's just apparently walked in the door holding a cup of coffee, and the robot is saying to him, "Hey man, would you tick this 'I'm not a robot' box for me?" So anyway, yes, little reversal.
Actually, it is kind of timely. Google has just updated their, they have that reCAPTCHA thing. You see that everywhere now.
Yeah.
And they've just put out version 3 that is a little, they say, more effective. I see it a lot now.
Well, it's nice, too, that where they're able, as we've talked about this before, sometimes all you have to do is just click the "I'm not a robot" button.
Because they know so much about you.
Yes, exactly. And they go, "Okay, yeah, well, we thought that, but we just wanted to make sure." It's like, "Oh, okay."
And then there's the ones that I really hate. It used to be, numbers, letters, and all the thing. The new one, you've seen this, is...
Oh, the grid of...
Yeah. Yep. They have 9 images... Click the ones that have a traffic light in it or a car in it.
Exactly. Or show a pedestrian or
something.
It's
so hard.
I get them wrong often.
All the time.
I'm not a robot.
Because they get the top of the head. Is that part? Is that picture? Is there a pedestrian in that picture? Is just a hair?
For a while, we were doing those street numbers, random photos of people's numbers on the side of the house.
That was to help Street View, because they were actually they couldn't always read those numbers in their Street View cars.
That's right.
Yeah. Fools.
Abuse your humans.
that's really what it is. Right. We know you're not a robot, but can you help out here?
So at 5:27 p.m. last Tuesday afternoon, the day that we were finishing up, last week we did the podcast in the morning.
Right.
In the afternoon, Microsoft acknowledged that zip file problem in Windows 10.
Oh, boy.
In a posting with a long title, believe it or not, this was in answers.microsoft.com. The title of the posting was, quote, "If you copy files from a .zip file without extracting them, they might not be copied or moved correctly, comma, even though it looks like they have been, period."
That's a very long starting
end of quote. Yes.
There.
So they explain, and it's useful for the exact what it is that they've done here. They wrote, "There is a known issue in the Windows 10 October update, where the consent prompt, quote, do you want to replace these files, which is really handy, unquote, that's me saying that. They didn't say that, is missing when copying contents from a zip file. With the Windows 10 October 2018 update, if you copy or move files from a .zip file without first extracting the contents into a new destination folder and I guess it really wouldn't be new because that contains duplicate file names or is write protected, you don't get a "Do you want to replace these files?" prompt. It will appear that the files were overwritten, when in fact the copy action for those files is not executed and files have not been overwritten. So that's a little news over what we understood to be the problem last week. There were reports on Reddit of overwrites. It looks like it thought it gave us the confirmation and we said, no, don't replace them. But it just skipped that step. So it looked like they were overwritten, but nothing happened. So then they explained this failure can occur in the following three scenarios: copying from a compressed file to a regular folder, moving from a compressed folder to a regular folder, or copying from a compressed folder to a protected folder. And then they said, no, while the copy action for the duplication file names does not complete and no files are overwritten, the move command will also silently fail and might remove or delete the moved file. That is, you were moving something, and as we know, moving means essentially copy and then delete from the source. So in that instance, there is a potential file loss problem where, again, it doesn't actually perform the copy, but it thinks it did, and so it removes the source of the file. So anyway, they said, we recommend you fully extract the zip folder before you copy files to a new destination folder to avoid this issue. They said, and if you deleted items at any point in this process, you can recover files that were not copied to the destination folder or were unintentionally recycled by doing the following. And then basically they explain about the recycle bin. So apparently that's where things go. Of course, I've never been a recycle bin advocate. I always – one of the first things I do when I'm setting up a new system is I turn that all off because, you know, I've got backups of my backups in any event. So if I really lost something, I could get it back. I just like it to go away. But in any event, so that's the story. And they said – and this is kind of curious. They said – Microsoft is working on a resolution and estimates a solution will be available in early November for this issue. Okay, well, tomorrow's Halloween in the U.S., to the end of October. So November starts on Thursday. But as a consequence of that timing, we don't have our second Tuesday, Patch Tuesday, until mid-November, essentially, November 13th. So, this is a potential data loss situation. So it's unclear whether they might push an out-of-cycle fix for this or if they're going to just say, like, everybody hold your breath for 2 weeks because, you know, it's 2 weeks from today is when this will be fixed unless they decide, okay, this is something we have to deal with sooner. So, don't know yet, and they're not saying. I mentioned some good news on the Android updates front from Google, and this is a consequence of The Verge that recently obtained some copies of confidential Google vendor contracts. So this is not a formal announcement. All we really had was back in May a statement of Google's intent. Back then, what The Verge coverage was, they said Google says it will require Android phone manufacturers to roll out security patches on a, quote, regular, unquote, basis, though it isn't clear who that requirement will apply to or how rigorous the mandate will be. And The Verge says on Wednesday, and this is back then in May, on Wednesday, during a talk at Google's annual developer conference that was caught by 9to5 Google via XDA developers, the company announced that many more users would receive regular security patches thanks to new agreements it's making with partners. David Kleidermacher, Google's head of Android security, reportedly said, quote, "When you have billions of users, it's a large target, and so it deserves the strongest possible defense. We've also worked on building security patching into our OEM agreements. Now this will really lead to a massive increase in the number of devices and users receiving regular security patches." And then The Verge finished the coverage back then saying, "Unfortunately, there are no details beyond that. We reached out to Google to learn how frequent the security updates will be and who they'll apply to," they wrote, "but the company didn't immediately have answers for us. It sounds," they wrote, "like the requirement will apply only to new phones launching on Oreo or later that take advantage of Google Play services, so likely nothing in China. Even then, it isn't clear whether it'll apply to all of Google's partners." So that was then. Now, today, with the benefit of these leaked confidential documents, The Verge has said, every month, a security team at Google, well, as we know, they're giving us some background, releases a new set of patches for Android. And every month, carriers and manufacturers, they wrote, struggle to get them installed on actual phones. It's a complex, long-standing problem, but confidential contracts obtained by The Verge show many manufacturers now have explicit obligations about keeping their phones updated written into their contract with Google.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. A contract obtained by The Verge requires Android device makers to regularly install updates for any popular phone or tablet for at least 2 years.
I wish it were longer, though. That's...
I know. I thought the same thing. It's like, okay. Because here we were just recently talking about old routers and how they've been abandoned, but they're still in use, and that's a problem. So The Verge wrote, Google's contract with Android partners stipulates that they must provide, quote, at least 4 security updates, unquote, within 1 year of the phone's launch. Security updates are mandated within the second year as well, though without a specified minimum number of releases. David Kleidermacher, Google's head of Android security, again referred to these terms earlier this year, and this is what they had said back in May. Said that Google had added a provision into its agreements with partners to roll out regular security updates, but it wasn't clear which devices those would apply to, how often those devices would come, or for how long. The terms cover any device launched after January 31st, 2018. Okay, so that's all of this year, after the first month of this year, that's been activated by more than 100,000 users. Okay, so failed devices, I guess, aren't important enough, or small user bases or small manufacturers maybe. Then starting July 31st, the middle of this year, the patching requirements were applied to 75% of a manufacturer's security mandatory models. Then, starting on January 31st, 2019, so again, 1 month into next year, Google will require that all security mandatory devices receive these updates. The Verge wrote, manufacturers have to patch flaws identified by Google within a specific time frame. By the end of each month, covered devices must be protected against all vulnerabilities identified more than 90 days ago. That means that even without an annual update minimum, this rolling window mandates that devices are regularly patched, or at least, within 90 days, within 3 months. Additionally, devices must launch with the same level of bug fix coverage. If manufacturers fail to keep their devices updated, Google says it could withhold approval of future phones, which could prevent them from being released. So, of course, our listeners know we've spoken of this often, that while – and in fact, I mean, we've despaired at the severity of some serious problems that have surfaced on Android, which Google's own devices are patched for responsibly and almost immediately, I mean, as quickly as one can. But the fact that all the other phones with the same level, the same version of Android, you know, may never be patched, and, you know, thus leaving huge numbers of users exposed to what then become publicly known vulnerabilities. And boy, if this podcast has shown us anything, it's that bad guys are now, I mean, this is like things that are patched are a source for some subset of hackers to jump on, reverse engineer what got changed, what was patched, and then turn that into an exploit and go after all the devices that have not yet received that same patch. So it's great that we're seeing Google, you know, recognizing that, you know, I mean, that their own Android ecosystem is suffering from the fact that they inherently and by design don't have the same kind of grip that Apple does over the iOS ecosystem, but that frankly for this kind of product with the reality of today's vulnerabilities, a tighter grip is necessary in order to protect the users. So anyway, props to The Verge for getting a hold of that contract, and now we have some sense for how this actually looks in the real world. And Sandbox Escaper, Leo, she's just still not having a good time. Her tweet read, "Here's a low-quality bug that is a pain to exploit, still unpatched. I'm done with all this anyway. Probably going to get into problems because of being broke now, but whatever." And, you know, the problem is I took a good look at this because there's a proof of concept with all the source code up on GitHub. It's deletebug1.rar under her GitHub account. And it's a nice piece of work. I mean, like, I wouldn't hire her, but somebody ought to. You know, this person should be employed. I mean, this takes some skills to find these sorts of things. So, you know, I mean, you'd have to make sure, you know, I don't know, maybe have her talk to somebody about her apparent depression. But boy, I mean, there is some skill there. So just to recap, back in late August, our listeners will remember when she was apparently having another bad day, she posted to Twitter to expose and to detail a proof of concept exploit for a local privilege vulnerability in Microsoft Windows Task Scheduler, which was due to its handling of an advanced local procedure call, the ALPC service. And as we know and covered, almost immediately after the proof of concept was released, you know, even though it wasn't a remote execution style vulnerability, I mean, not the end of the world, as we said at the time, even like malware, I mean, this would even be useful for any malware that could get into your system in order to elevate its own privileges to do more damage. And that is exactly what happened. It wasn't long after the zero-day dropped that we found malware using exactly this in order to give itself privileges, you know, system-level privileges, and deal with the fact that a user properly using a non-privileged account could still get malware installed into the system, which non-privileged users, it's the reason they don't have privilege, is, you know, it's a kind of a pain not to, but it's supposed to prevent this. So we know that, like, it didn't take long for this, what many in the industry felt was an irresponsible disclosure of a zero day. So it's happened again. What she's describing as a low quality bug is something she found in a new DLL, something known as the Microsoft Data Sharing Service. It's DSSVC.DLL. It's a new service introduced in Windows 10. So unlike the previous proof of concept, which went way back into Windows history, so it affected all versions of Windows. This one that she's just dropped now is Windows 10 and both of the descendant servers, Server 2016 and 2019, are vulnerable to a misuse of what she has found and proven. So it does not affect 7 and 8.1 or their server versions. The service, this Microsoft Data Sharing Service, runs with local system, which is to say root or kernel, full kernel privileges, because it serves as a data brokering agent between applications. That's what this does. And so if you are able to abuse this, and she has figured out how, the abuser is essentially a process, this DLL, running in the kernel. So the proof of concept exploit code is deletebug.exe, which people can download. Don't run it, though. What it demonstrates
– okay.
Please don't run it. She uses this to delete a critical system service, the PCI.sys file, which you have to have to boot. So it immediately renders a system unbootable. So, don't try this at home. But it convincingly demonstrates the fact that this is doing something it should not be able to do. And unfortunately, all the source code is there. Nothing is hidden. And she just said, here you go. I'm having another bad day. So, you know, I just found this and I'm letting the world know. So it generated, as her actions have in the past, some feedback. And I was sort of curious, so I read through the Twitter stream a little bit. Amitka Kalsek retweeted a response from Microsoft Security, and he tweeted, "Hey girl, in case you missed this," and then reiterated the tweet, and he said, "Please continue with your work in this area and get paid by Microsoft. What you're finding are not easy to find bugs. And your proof of concepts and write-ups are of high quality."
Awesome.
And I completely agree. Yeah. I mean, it's top drawer stuff. It's really good work. And he said, "There, you should know this. Cheers." And Microsoft Security response was, "Yes, this vulnerability is in scope for the Windows Insider Preview Bounty Program." So
get your money here.
Get some money. And then I did get a kick out of, unfortunately, Peter Stevesant also, and he's tweeting from Binary Fraud 2017 is his handle, on October 26th. He responded to both of those previous tweets, and he said, "Well, when you see how much MS, Microsoft, pay for exploit, you should sell them to," and then he gives the URL, and we've talked about them before, http://zerodium.com, which of course is the zero-day reseller. And he says, "They will consider your work much better." And I guess he's meaning you will be better paid for that. But, you know, in any event, dropping 0 days like this. I mean, they're beautifully engineered. And unfortunately, what that means is they are immediately snatched up by any malware that wants to be able to bypass the whole Windows privilege system. That's what this is doing. So, yes, it doesn't immediately allow bad stuff to get in. But, boy, you know, I mean, if you click on something in email that like a phishing attack, like, for example, that you were just talking about from this previous sponsor, Leo,
right.
You know, the bad stuff, you've given it a chance to run. Well, the whole idea of having privileges on accounts is only so that most people don't have them. And this just cuts through that. You know, and yes, Microsoft will fix this immediately. I'm sure we'll see this fixed 2 weeks from today on November 13th. But there's now, like, there's 2 weeks between now and then. And then there's also the patch delay. Because, boy, after October's disaster, I don't think anybody's going to be in a big hurry to fix this. Oh, and I forgot to mention those little micro patch folks that do at zeropatch.com. They do have a fix for this already. So if you're in an environment where you think you would be exposed to this kind of problem, there you don't have to wait for Microsoft. I've talked about these guys before. It's numericzeropatch.com, and they're able to respond within hours of these sorts of disclosures to fix these. They call them micro patches to fix these little vulnerabilities until Microsoft performs the official update. So one is available for this too. Okay, so Apache Hadoop. I just love saying it. Hadoop. It's just
so does Mary Jo Foley. She loves saying it too.
So it's a collection of open source software utilities which facilitate using a network of many computers to solve problems involving massive amounts of data, you know, huge data sets and computation. And you get to say Hadoop in the process. It provides a software framework for distributed software and processing of big data using the MapReduce programming model, and whatever that is. I've never had a chance and had an occasion to dig into that.
That's a Google big data engine.
Okay. Yeah. So, and I'm just quoting from Wikipedia here. Originally designed for computer clusters built from commodity hardware, still the common use. So that means you get to take like bunches of off-the-shelf stuff and right. just put it all together, and Hadoop somehow corrals it all and manages it with MapReduce, whatever that is. And Wikipedia says it is also found used on clusters. And here is the problem of high-end hardware. All the modules in Hadoop are designed with the fundamental assumption that that hardware failures are common occurrences and should be automatically handled by the framework, which is like a dream, right? You just throw a whole bunch of stuff that's kind of limping and Hadoop, you know, fixes it, works with what it has somehow. And if something dies, it goes, oh, well, and works around it. Okay, so as a consequence of this Hadoop cluster nature, it turns out that Hadoop clusters, and I'm going to say Hadoop as many times as I can during this, Hadoop clusters are often very powerful, well-connected, and placed into the internet cloud, where, unfortunately, they are accessible either deliberately or by mistake. So it turns out that Hadoop has something called YARN, which is an abbreviation for yet another resource negotiator. And sounds like something Hadoop would need, right? Because it's about resource negotiation. And apparently there were some before. This is yet another one. So YARN, it provides cluster resource management for enterprise Hadoop deployments, has had a known flaw in the handling of its REST API, which is an HTTP-based API, for which a Metasploit proof of concept was published after a 21 line, which is to say not very long or complicated or hard to understand, Python source proof of concept was posted onto GitHub, get this, 7 months ago, last March. I have a link to this exploit.py file, and it's just like, oh, I mean, that works? And it turns out, yes, unfortunately, 7 months later, it still works. There's a Metasploit module, which in its description, it says this module exploits an unauthenticated command execution vulnerability in Apache Hadoop through Resource Manager REST API. And so I have a link there too. So now what we know is that unfortunately there exist on the internet publicly exposed Hadoop clusters which have not been patched in 7 months since this was known and made public. So Radware, the security guys, have reported that an entity known that actually identifies itself as DaemonBot, it does not self-propagate in worm style, which is to say that infections do not themselves look for other vulnerable systems. But they have identified a growing number of servers. They cited the number 70 servers, which use, and I love their term for this, they called it the spray and pray tactic to blindly find and infect millions of exposed, publicly available, and of course, unpatched Hadoop instances. They're using them to run crypto miningware. And also being used to source extremely powerful, thus DaemonBot, extremely powerful and debilitating DDoS attacks, which unfortunately these Hadoop instances are really well equipped to do because they are typically on high-end hardware and on very well connected to the internet pipes. So large bandwidth, often on strong servers and able to launch high bandwidth attacks. So very much as with the millions of compromised routers and other insecure, publicly exposed and vulnerable services, attacks such as these will be part of the internet terrain until we figure out how to build secure systems out of the box, if we ever do. And it's funny too, because again, I was introducing my old friends from high school to the idea that I was in the 13th year of a podcast. They said, one of them said, "You haven't run out of stuff to talk about after 13 years?"
We just and I said,
oh no. And I think that may have been the dialogue that got us into, and how long do you talk every week about this stuff? Mm-hmm. And I said, 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And they said, what?
Somebody's doing the math right now. Yeah,
a lot of time. And Leo, speaking of which, I think we should take our second break, and I will we'll continue with the Department of Defense's problems with securing themselves.
Ooh, Hadoop. You probably don't have things like map functions in assembly language, but you might have written a map macro. It applies a function to a set of data, like. I don't know. You have 15 items with a price, and you run it through the map function to find out what the total price is. Or actually, map would change each price by 10%. Then you have a new list with 10% higher, and reduce takes it and says, "What is the total price?" So MapReduce is designed. Google used to use it; they don't use it anymore. But it's designed to handle like gigabytes of data and do that kind of thing to it.
Actually, I did spend, you'll remember, a lot of time on a longest repeated strings algorithm.
Yes, right.
Which was able to take a massive corpus and in relatively short time, identify any repetitions of the string.
Perfect.
Similar.
Similar. Our show today brought to you by the folks who bring you the show. If that sounds a little confusing, it shouldn't be, because it's brought to you by our content distribution network, the great folks at Cashfly. When you download a show, whether you subscribe to it in a podcast application, you download it on your Amazon Echo, you ask for a show. If you go to our website and download it, in every case, you're getting it from a server that's geographically close to you running on the Cashfly network. That's what a CDN does, a content distribution network. It has many, many servers all over the world close to you that you're able to get data from. But Cashfly is awesome because, you know, this notion of caching your data usually means a lot of changes to your environment. It's a complicated thing to do. Cashfly does it easier. And there's things you can do with Cashfly. Things like, well, how about a WAF, a web application firewall? If you use a CDN to distribute applications or for SaaS, setting up a WAF with Cashfly is so easy. You could do it like that. And do you have the confidence to run your WAF if you're using one in blocking mode? That's the most secure way to do it. But many WAF solutions make that so hard, perhaps you haven't turned it on. Cashfly's WAF is designed to operate where your applications live. Over 95% of the people who use Cashfly's WAF are running in full blocking mode. So they are absolutely safe and secure. When others require significant changes, Cashfly makes it simple. Stop attacks as they occur thanks to real-time security, visibility, and protection. Get real-time data that pinpoints attacks or anomalies. We got to get Steve on this. When he's getting DDoSed, you know immediately whatever tools you're using, whether it's Slack or Jira or Splunk or Kibana or whatever, free your people up and your systems to focus valuable time on serious threats instead of a bunch of false positives. Say goodbye to headaches caused by broken internet traffic. Your web application firewall from Cashfly will protect you, and you can run it in full blocking mode, and you will be very, very happy. They've been building trusted CDN relationships since 2002. Each month, you, our listeners and viewers, download petabytes of data from the Cashfly servers. And it's, I never get a call. I never get a 3 a.m. alarm. I never get, the CDN is down. I don't have to worry about it. And if you're using a modern infrastructure and you want a web application firewall, there is no better way to do it. Cashfly's WAF is designed to operate right where your applications live with seamless integration. This has to be the month you start running your WAF in block mode with Cashfly. Let Cashfly give you some sanity back. By the way, on average, customers who switch to Cashfly save more than 20%. Just imagine what you could do with that extra 20%. We save a ton. I don't think Twit could exist without Cashfly. We've got an offer just for Security Now listeners. Get a free consultation and learn more about Cashfly at securitynow.cashfly.com. Check it out, securitynow.cashfly.com. Use that address, let them know you heard it here. securitynow.cashfly.com. Back we go to Steve Areno.
So, 2 weeks after that rather horrifying Government Accountability Office, the GAO report, detailing glaring cybersecurity issues in weapon systems at the U.S. Department of Defense, the DOD has announced that it is expanding its existing Hack the Pentagon bug bounty program to include hardware assets. And Leo, I really don't understand how that's going to work, because, you know, how do you hack an F-35?
That's all I'm saying. I think that's fair, right?
We own one of those over here, and let me plug my USB stick into it. But somehow they're saying they're gonna do this. So they're gonna be tapping that the Synac, the HackerOne, and the Bug Crowd platforms, which are the existing bug reporting bug bounty organizing platforms, to attract more white hats to this effort. And to me, this feels like, okay, I'm, you know, like not really convinced that this is going to work. But they said since the Hack the Pentagon program was kicked off in 2016, the bug hunters have found, and I wasn't aware of this, so that's this 2 years ago, 5,000, which is a little distressing too, 5,000 code vulnerabilities and six public-facing bounty challenges have been run, including the most recent, which was Hack the Marine Corps in August. Other sessions have focused on the Air Force, Army, and the Defense Travel Service. A three-year, $34 million, and this is what this new contract is, and this is, you know, bureaucratic jargon. They called it the Indefinite Delivery, Indefinite Quantity contract package, covering this these three bug bounty managing companies, will crowdsource vetted hackers to probe the DoD's websites, hardware, and physical systems. And again, it's like, okay, but you know,
I guess they're going to let them in.
Add an atom bomb? I don't know. That doesn't sound. So, according to the contract's performance work statement, the government expects its military contractors to run at least 8 limited time challenges and 5 continuous challenges during the first year of the 3-year contract, and more if an option in the contract is exercised. Each program will last between 3 months to a year, and they might overlap. You know, and I was thinking about this, Leo. It seems to me that virtually all of the interesting and critical systems are classified, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, and again, what I was wondering was, because we know that there's I don't know if you'd call it interagency or interdepartmental or division. We know that there's like competition between the Army and the Navy and Marines and so forth. So I wonder what would happen if instead of involving external white hats, if you instead like open the systems up to interdivisional hackers. So like it's like the Marine hackers could try to get into the Army's systems and vice versa. If that might, you know, be something that would be feasible, because again, it's hard for me to believe that, you know, I can sign up to Bug Crowd and be vetted and be given access to hardware, which is, you know, like, and said, here, Steve, you know, hack this system, see if you can get in. It's like, really? So, no, okay. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how this pans out. To me, it seems like it would make sense if you kept it within because the reason I was thinking about this is that we know that for hacking, you really have to have an adversarial posture. You can't have like programmers check their own code. You've got to have programmers who are unfamiliar with the system and who are truly like, you know, motivated to get into somebody else's system trying to do that in order to find this class of problem. And so it just seemed to me if you had a situation where you could set up a true competition, then but also sort of keeping it in the family, that is, or like within people who had security clearances, then, you know, maybe you could get the same effect, but like also be able to pull it off. Because I'll be surprised if people without high-end security clearance really ever get to touch, you know, high-end hardware. So it'd be interesting to see. And I was a little surprised, Leo, when I heard that Docker engine APIs were exposed. And the good news is not a lot of them. So as we know, Docker creates a sort of a universal packaging approach that bundles all of an application's dependency into a container, so that you don't to solve the whole dependency hell problem, you create a Docker container that is just sort of a drop-in solution. You just put it into an environment that runs containers, and it will run because it brings everything it needs with it. So these Docker engines are available for Linux on the CentOS, Debian, Fedora, Oracle's Linux, Red Hat, SUSE, and Ubuntu, and also Windows Server has a Dockerd service, a Docker daemon that's able to also do runtime Dockers. So it turns out that, believe it or not, and our regular listeners will believe it, this Docker engine is a server which interacts with its local environment via an API. That API exists exposed, in some cases, on the public internet. Or, as Trend Micro put it in their security advisory, quote, misconfigured container abused to deliver cryptocurrency mining malware. They wrote, we recently observed cases of abuse of the system of systems running misconfigured Docker engine community. That is the community edition. There's a community and an enterprise sort of classes of these, with Docker application program interface, that is API, ports exposed. We also noticed that the malicious activities, they wrote, were focused on scanning for open ports 2375 over TCP and 2376 over TCP, which are used by the Docker engine daemon, Dockerd. The intrusion attempts to deploy a cryptocurrency mining malware, which their software, Trend Micro, found as CoinMiner on the misconfigured systems. So this Docker API allows remote users to control Docker images like a local Docker client does. Opening the API port for external access, they wrote, is not recommended. Yeah, no kidding. As it can allow attackers to abuse this misconfiguration for malicious activities. Now, unlike routers, where by policy these services are open and vulnerable, which we've been covering really pretty much this year, the Docker engine itself isn't compromised or abused, and the Docker Enterprise platform is not affected. The Docker Enterprise platform has very strong authentication that cannot be bypassed. But Trend Micro wrote that they found rare instances of abuse on the Docker community version. So people have to really work in order, it turns out, to make this exposure public. It's not clear, whether they have to explicitly open ports to the public, or if they install a Docker community instance on a public server, if just essentially sheer negligence ends up exposing these systems. The good news is there are not hundreds of thousands of these instances. There are hundreds of them, as in like a low number of hundreds. Trend Micro reported a peak of, looks like from their graph that I have in the show notes, maybe about 425. It looks like it peaked around early October, and then it sort of jumped up and down based on their scans. So anyway, I was just sort of surprised that there were any instances of this. It does look like, though, since Docker is very popular and it's certainly in use in hundreds of thousands of systems, it looks like only in a few hundred, because this malware is scanning aggressively They're seeing a scan rate of 50,000 packets per second, looking for opening for open ports 2375 and 2376. So it is attempting to move laterally. If it gets into a network, it scans all networks it's accessible to. So the problem, of course, is that it'll have a if Docker is there in an enterprise where there is a publicly exposed instance, once that gets infected, it is acting as a worm, which is turning around and is scanning into the intranet looking for additional instances where it may be able to jump. So they've only seen it peaked around 425 instances, but who knows what those instances may have found when they pivoted and then looked inward into organizations that may be using Docker pervasively. So again, the good news is unlike routers, the Docker designers clearly understand the importance of not letting this API be exposed. And by default, it appears that it's not. But even then, you just can't keep people from misconfiguring systems. And Leo, you are going to love this next piece.
Okay.
What is the going rate for DDoS for hire? As a result of Fortinet's threat research, we now know in at least one instance they have screenshots of the front end of a DDoS for hire service powered by what's known as the Bushido botnet. And I have to get a little closer to the screen here to read this. In fact, looks like in the compressed version I can't. But I know that there was the bronze, the silver, and the gold for $20 for I have it down below. The $20 for the bronze plan, you were able to purchase that, and you got 900 seconds of DDoS, which is 15 minutes. And the bronze plan gets you one concurrent attack using what they call their standard network. This goes all the way up. You have the bronze, the silver, and the gold. But then you can also go from the standard to the VIP. So you also have bronze, silver, and gold in the VIP package. So the highest end plan is the $150 VIP gold plan. So again, you have three tiers and three medals, bronze, silver, and gold. So a total of nine different plans ranging from $20 to $150. The $150 VIP gold plan buys you 7,200 seconds, which is 2 hours, offering two concurrent attacks using their VIP network, whatever that is. And then through the browser UI, you're able to select which types of plan you want. And two pages down in the show notes, just because I thought this was really fun, is the current gigabits per second offered by their DDoS attack tools. And when the screenshot was taken, it was 424 gigabits per second.
It says gigabytes.
Capital
B, isn't that a byte?
Yeah, I think it's probably gigabits.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's bits because that's normally what we think of in terms of network speed, right? is in bits. But still, you know, that's almost half a terabit per second of flooding bandwidth. So, I mean, that's, you know, goodbye target. I mean, that's meltdown. And at the time, again, that this was taken, this site is the Oxbooter site. And, of course, these are all couched not as, we're not selling you attack. This is to like stress test your network. Okay.
Oh yeah, sure.
424 gigabits is not a stress test. It is, you know, it's the center of the sun. So at the time that this page, that this web interface was, the snapshot was taken, they had 16,993 bots present in their network waiting for marching orders. Where would you like us to aim the attack?
Wow.
So Fortinet writes, distributed denial of service offerings often disguised, they said, as legitimate booter or stressor services, they said, continue to increase in the cyber underground market. This relatively new crime as a service trend has created an entry point for novice DDoS attackers, offering a simple option to anonymously attack nearly any website, forcing it offline for a small fee. They wrote, due to the public release of the source code of some popular bots, and of course, Mirai, we've spoken of, is among them, building a botnet to provide these services is now simpler than ever. A quick Google search returns lists of resources for botnet builders, usually with complete step-by-step instructions, because why not? Being able to reuse and even modify the source code has enabled cybercriminals to create their own versions that implement new functionalities. Oh, and Fortinet will be delivering a talk during the upcoming BotConf 2018, being held this coming December 4th through 8th in Toulouse, France. During this talk, Fortinet will be detailing the reuse of Mirai source code and the effect it has had upon the development of other botnets in their presentation titled Mirai Beyond the Aftermath. So anyway, they wrote, during our regular monitoring, the FortiGuard Labs team recently discovered a new platform, and this is the one we've been talking about, offering DDoS for hire services called OX-Booter, first appearing on October 17th, so only 2 weeks ago, October 17th, OX-Booter is available to anyone who signs up on the website. This service comes with a simple-to-use interface which enables practically anyone to learn and use the service. Initiating a DDoS attack is made through a web user interface, which eliminates the need for direct contact between the user and the botmaster. In the attack hub interface, the details of the host or domain, the port, the attack duration, and the type of attack can all be selected before launch. So, yes, now it's just a matter of going to a website and saying, I'm annoyed with this, with these people, zap them for me, please. And if you are willing to fork over some cash, ranging, you know, $25 for a couple minutes to sort of evidence your displeasure with someone, to more for a couple hours, you can now do that in DDoS for hire. The world we live in today. Wow. Middle of last week, Microsoft dropped their post-patch Tuesday. They normally do that like a few days later, like on Thursday, bug fix, which are not the security updates, but just fixing like their grab bag of stuff. And this was an opportunity for me to verify that this system that I've been writing about, or rather that I mentioned, which was Windows 10 Home, which I updated to Pro in order to set a delay. I went back when I was putting this together on Sunday and checked for anything new. And it got any updates for me? Nothing. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I set the delay down to zero and asked again. And sure enough, I got KB 442-442-6233, which was available but had been held off because that's what I had asked for. So I knew it was there, so I was able to verify, in fact. And the list of what it fixes is really, I mean, it's really extensive. But to give you a sense for it, it addresses the redenomination of local currency that the Central Bank of Venezuela implemented to enter the Bolivar Soberano into circulation, because of course you'd want that. Addresses an issue that prevents the clock and date flyout from appearing when the region format is Spanish and the sorting method is traditional, because not having that flyout would be a problem. Addresses an issue that causes the get calendar info function to return a wrong value for the Japanese era. Addresses an issue in which applications have handle leaks when using client authentication certificates with the TLS protocol. This issue occurs when the free credentials handle call occurs before the delete security context call in the application code. And things like that. Addresses an issue in which scheduled tasks configured to run on a specific day of the week don't execute at the expected time, and so on. Anyway, so, you know, there's things, I mean, and that's like a tenth of all of the stuff that it fixes. So just a grab bag of things for Windows 10 that they had on their list of things to fix that they did not put into the security update, because these are arguably not security sensitive things, just, you know, fixing little cruft around the edges of Windows 10. So I've heard no reports. That was released on Thursday. No reports of it causing unexpected problems. I haven't had any, and I did immediately reset my hold off day counters back to, I think it's 2 weeks for security and a couple months for the feature update, because I definitely want to like wait till everybody else has gotten any arrows in their back, if they're going to, before I, you know, hurt this system that I get to talk to our Security Now listeners to, or over every week. So, anyway, that Firefox has made its move to version 63, which now brings the built-in tracking protection that we were foretelling of. In their update, they said it shouldn't be hard to own your life online. So they have now built-in tracking controls. And after you update and you go to a site which is attempting to track you, up comes this really nice multi-page tutorial. It's interesting because I have I can't think of it. The U I'm blanking on it. uBlock Origin. Yeah. I have uBlock Origin installed, and so I was somewhere and I wasn't seeing anything that happened. And so I turned off uBlock Origin, and suddenly Firefox jumped in and said, "Oh, look, there's something to do here." So so uBlock Origin sort of was in there preemptively. When I turned it off, then Firefox said, "Oh," and I got this whole like, "Look at this little shield that appears in your URL bar, and we've got these little." I mean, I got a whole little tutorial. So Firefox users who update will be told about all this. However, it is still not enabled by default. I had gone in and manually enabled it in the earlier build before they surfaced it out on the UI. So what version 63 does is it brings it out to the UI, as enhanced tracking protection, they call it. So if you go under option, you know, go in the menu, choose options, then select the privacy and security tab on the left-hand side. Under content blocking, at the section at the top, it's content blocking. There's two checkboxes, which is all detected trackers and also third-party cookies, probably both of which you want to enable. And this is very fine-grained. So you should be aware if you turn these things on, because they're being careful. It's there now. It's in the UI, but it still defaults to off. So I think our listeners who are Firefox users should probably flip that on. But be aware that it might upset some sites that could be dependent upon third-party activities, you know, some forms of tracking in order to function. The good news is you have highly granular control to turn that off. And also I poked in a little bit and dug around under this tracking protection where you customize it. There is an option, and I have showed a picture of the screen that I got under block lists, and you can currently choose. They're using the disconnect.me block list, which is, you know, highly regarded. And so there's two. There's basic protection and strict protection. They're recommending basic. So and the description says allows some trackers so websites function properly. In other words, disconnect.me has found that if they used absolute strict blocking, it can't. There are some known problems with that. But again, a user who really, that's what you want, you can choose the non-default strict protection in that by clicking that link, then select disconnect me strict protection. But then sort of be aware that if something doesn't seem to be working, you are able to still do per site overrides in order to allow it when it's necessary. So, and as we know, we've seen some benchmarks where blocking content really does produce a startling increase in speed, because so many pages have become now so heavy with just stuff that they're dragging along. So I know that we've talked already about turning on content blocking and how much faster it makes things. So Firefox is moving forward. And Leo, I've heard you on other podcasts with your guests talking about this sort of this growing distinction that we're sort of presuming will exist as Firefox increasingly profiles itself as the anti-tracking,
right,
privacy-focused browser, whereas Google just can't.
They can't.
With Chrome,
no.
Because that's their lifeblood.
That's their business.
I mean, it's what's paying for all the free services that we get from Google, and you know, as you said, yeah, it's their business. So, it hasn't stopped people from making Chrome the number one browser on the net, but it's nice to see that Mozilla and Firefox are finding a niche for themselves, because I still like the way they handle tabs. And you know, I imagine I would switch to Chrome if they ever got tabs right, but that doesn't seem to be something that they're focused on at this point. So, I had in the show notes also, if you put in the URL about:preferences/privacy, that takes you directly to that page. And I did mention I don't think this is worth worrying much about. But it did get some coverage around the internet. A local privilege escalation vulnerability in Linux and FreeBSD. It's been fixed, so watch for updates from your platform's packager. An Indian security researcher discovered a flaw in the x.org X Windows server package, which impacts OpenBSD and most Linux distributions, including Debian, Ubuntu, CentOS, Red Hat, and Fedora. Exploitation of the flaw would allow a lower privileged user to create or overwrite a file or files anywhere on a system, including files owned by privileged users. And in this example, the etc/shadow file for passwords was used as an example. However, the attacker would require a console session to exploit the issue. But as we've, you know, SSH could be used to get a console session remotely. So I guess the concern would be probably not an individual user at home, but if you had a system where you were depending upon the system privileges protecting unprivileged users or preventing unprivileged users from getting to sensitive areas of the system, where an unprivileged user could arrange to bring up a console, this could be a problem. What was found was that the log file option on the X Windows server config was vulnerable to a format string vulnerability, which could be abused by a local attacker. Xorg immediately fixed the problem and issued updates. So it doesn't feel like it's a super critical problem for, as I said, for the typical end user at home, but maybe in an enterprise scenario, it would be something that people would want to get onto immediately. And again, it's fixed. Apparently, it's the server exists and is invocable even if it's not in active use throughout those distributions. So it's there and vulnerable to exploitation. And so worth, you know, like removing it if you don't need it, or if you do, then updating it so that you're not in trouble. Also, just a little bit of errata, two pieces. An anonymous listener in, Chickawaga, New York?
Yeah, Chickawaga.
Chickawaga. Never said that word before. Chickawaga, New York, observed, he said, and apparently I just misspoke. He said, as you said it, /.. doesn't do anything special. And yeah, that would be true. He says slash would be the root directory and the parent of the root is the root because it already it really has no parent. So he says you probably meant to say ./, which is definitely what I meant to say. So I guess I misspoke. So I meant to say ./ because as we know that the .. backs you up a level in the directory hierarchy. So ./././ moves you successively up the, you know, back up toward the root in the tree. And I guess I said /./ by mistake. So thank you for that correction. And a number of people also noted that in my discussion of real-time operating systems, RTOSes, remember free RTOS was the one that I was talking about, I guess it was last week. One of the things I failed to mention was that real time means real time. That is, it's often one of the other characteristics of it, and I failed to talk about it at all, and which led some people to say, Steve, what you were really was describing was an embedded OS, wasn't it? So they certainly have a good point. One of the other things you get in what is a real-time operating system is real-time guarantees of response. For example, there's no such thing in Windows. You know, it's like it's sort of best effort. If things aren't working right, then or if another process is hogging all the processor, for example, mining. If you have a coin miner running on your system that is misbehaving, the rest of your system is really sluggish because it's sucking up all of your processor resources. In a real-time OS, one of the things that microkernel, that minimal set of services guarantees is guaranteed response. Meaning, for example, that you often have hardware interrupts that need real-time service. And so, like, to do audio audio, real-time audio playback, or, you know, whatever, like running a robot arm. So you might, you want the to involve the processor in the servo control loop of a robot arm. So what it needs is you absolutely have to provide a guarantee that within X number of microseconds or milliseconds, you guarantee that the interrupt service routine will get run in order to perform the actions that you're requiring in real time. So that's another set of characteristics unique to a real-time operating system, separate from an embedded OS, which may not necessarily provide those, and certainly any of our consumer OSs where it's just like, well, gee, things seem slow. I guess I better get a faster machine or give it more memory or something. And I also, Leo, I wanted to take a moment just to, since I thought we would have time and we do, to talk a little bit about Salvation, which during my trip, I took an iPad mini with me, which is now my favorite reading device. And by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, the Kindle for iPad got the feature I most love on Kindle, which is the ability to smooth scroll. It's why I use iAnnotate, and then they also have an iRead. I guess maybe it's iReader. Those are that's my PDF reader of choice, because it doesn't page the PDFs. It just lets me smoothly scroll through them, which I really prefer. And until a recent update, the Kindle app on iOS, for the pads or for the phone, was still a page at a time. They added the long sought feature of smooth scrolling, which I really appreciate. Anyway, Leo, you went through the Commonwealth books, and there have been several of them. First was Pandora's Star, and then Judas Unchained, which was a fabulous pair of books where we learned about the Commonwealth. That was Hamilton's reality, where what we learned was that in this Commonwealth, the Commonwealth was basically built on wormhole technology. Some of the main characters had figured out how to create a portal which could be used to link planets. And so, and cleverly, what I like about Hamilton, and I'm now seeing this pattern, is he'll take a fundamental innovation and, like, build a fully realized reality around what if that was true. And so there was, like, cool things, like cool consequences of what if you actually had wormholes that were expensive to maintain, because they had, like, used vast amounts of energy and huge complexes had to be built around them in order to maintain this spatial energy warp of some kind to zero the distance between distant places. The presumption being this is like a lot of effort to do, so we're not going to have many of them, and so they're expensive. So what you do is you bring back trains. So, and that's what he had. He had, he ran train tracks through these wormholes, and so that's the way you efficiently use this expensive yet cool transit system is – the idea being that you'd have switch yards on both sides where you'd be staging both passengers and goods and thus keep these very expensive to create and maintain wormholes busy by using trains. Okay, so that was that. That was the Commonwealth. In this new, and there's really, I guess it would be called the Salvation reality. What the similar sort of innovation are quantum entanglement portals, and so they're like portals, which are unlike wormholes, lots of like, I mean, you need installations. You need sort of like mountain size installations with lots of power and you know, reactors around them and so forth. These things, these quantum entanglement portals, they're almost free. They're cheap. So imagine you have this portal of varying diameters, which is inexpensive, and you create it, and then you pull them apart, and so they use quantum entanglement, whatever. I mean, we know what that is in theory, but so his extension is, okay, they're just doorways that are, you're able to separate in physical space, yet it's still a portal that has zero space if you go through it. So, of course, they're used on a planetary scale, but it turns out what he realized was, okay, if you actually had these, we would use them for all kinds of things. So, for example, in this future, virtually all transportation has gone away. It's just on foot now, and you have hubs of portals that link you to other hubs after you just like cross through a hub room. And so after crossing through three or four interlinked hub rooms, you're like pretty much wherever you want to be. And the very wealthy have homes where the home is a hub room, and the different rooms of the home are on different areas of the earth or on different planets. Like the kids' room is on the moon, and it's a big crystal dome with, you know, where the kids have their toys and they're looking up at the earth. And when you walk through the door, you're now back on earth. Anyway, the one thing that I thought was so clever about him is, imagine you want to bring a large portal somewhere, that is by foot, but it's a large portal, and so you can't. Well, he, again, being so clever, he has this concept of threading, where you in a backpack or in, you know, something you can carry, you bring a small portal, which is quantum entangled to a portal back wherever at the headquarters. And once you get to where you want a big portal to be, you engage a device which pushes a very wide and very narrow portal through the small portal. Now you have a very long and narrow portal. Had to be narrow to be able to come through the small diameter portal, which, so now essentially you have a portal that's a long slot. And so the next phase is a piece of threading equipment at the other end now pushes a full size portal through the slot. And now you have a large diameter working portal wherever it is you went. So again, that gives away none of the plot, but it's just some of the cool technology that he has created in this very richly realized reality. And, you know, props to him. I'm having a lot of fun with this book, which I had a lot of time to read during my recent trip to visit my high school friends. And Sunday, as I was pulling all this together, I found a neat note from actually somebody in your town, Leo, in Petaluma, Ben Willerson. The subject was, "It really does fix SSDs. Thank God." And I realized he probably meant that maybe literally. So on the 23rd, he wrote, "Dear Stephen Leo," he says, "everyone says they love the podcast. I haven't said it before, so add me to that list. My daily commute is hell," he says, "since Leo's in Petaluma, he knows. although you guys don't fix that, you make it more tolerable. He said, my SpinRite story will not be as important to you as it is to me. It could not be. But I hope you find this, since others need to know what happened. Several years ago, I switched to an SSD to get more space, but also since I figured a solid state storage drive would be failure proof. What could go wrong? It cannot crash. There's nothing but reliable solid state memory inside. So I was less careful about keeping backups. I did more at first, somewhat, but everything was working until last Monday morning, when I turned the PC on after the weekend and it said, missing operating system. He said, I had done a huge amount of work using that computer, and all that data was only there since I had stopped backing up. So I see. So he'd done a huge amount of work that was only on that computer because he hadn't backed up in a long time. He said, the first thing I tried was moving the SSD to a different computer to see if I could at least get back the data. But the other computer wanted to format the SSD and it was not accessible at all. My next thought was SpinRite. Like you have said, it can be used for maintenance to keep this from ever happening in the first place, but it has also recovered other people's SSDs. And he said, I was thinking about that security camera crashing story, which we talked about a couple weeks ago. He said, the subject of this email gives away the ending. I bought SpinRite from your website, and it was running on that SSD within a few minutes. I don't know whether you believe in the power of prayer, but I do. He says, I write this letter because of the relief I felt when the entire drive reappeared with nothing lost after SpinRite finished with it. Bless you and bless SpinRite. Thank you. And Ben,
yay.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Nice.
And one little bit of closing the loop from a listener. And then we'll take our final break and we'll talk about securing vending machines. This was a good point. Andrew Cooper in Sydney, Australia, said that the subject was inside the intranet should not be considered safe. And he said, Steve, first let me say that I've been listening to Security Now almost since it began. I really enjoy the way you cover topics from the high level right down to the technical nitty gritty. However, something's been niggling at me for a while. There have been many times when you've been discussing a vulnerability in some protocol or service that you've implied or explicitly said that as long as it's not exposed to the public internet, then it's okay. I heard it again today in your discussion on the Live 555 server on Security Now 686. This may have been true in the past, but it hasn't been for a while. For many years now, the larger security-conscious organizations have known that it's not safe to trust the intranet. It started over 10 years ago with talk of APTs, Advanced Persistent Threats, and the disappearing perimeter, and today has developed into a mindset that informs all security discussions and decisions. Microsoft's phrase is assume breach. While this mindset is especially true for medium and large organizations, it should also be a consideration for smaller networks. Even if your employees or family members are 100% trustworthy, as a well-executed social engineering attack, and again, Leah, what you were talking about at the beginning of the podcast with this new sponsor, could result in some code running on a PC or even a phone that can then use a vulnerability in an internal service to dig its way deeper into the network and pivot to other targets. And of course, we know that was what the Sony attack exactly was, the profile of what bit Sony. Of course, this mindset needs to also consider the value of potential targets and the likelihood of attack. It's probably overkill for most home networks and even some small offices, but I don't think it's helpful to encourage the thinking that if it's behind the firewall, it's okay. That said, thank you for all the hard work you put into the podcast every week. Keep it going. Regards, Andrew. And point taken. And so I wanted to share that with our listeners, because certainly, and I did mention that earlier in this podcast, that, you know, for example, in the Linux privilege escalation attack, if you had somebody you didn't trust on the intranet and you had a Linux machine where you were depending upon its security boundaries, that could potentially create a breach. So I will be more careful about that in the future. Thank you, Andrew, and a good note for our listeners as well.
Indeed. Let's take a little tiny time out, talk about our sponsor, and we will get back to the week's puzzler, which I'm dying to know the answer to, as I'm sure you are. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. If you're already an IT professional, you know that getting the certs that you needed to get that job was the toughest part about getting the job. Once you get the job, you learn on the job, but of course, it's always a good idea to learn more, keep those chops up to date, and learn new skills. IT Pro TV is great for both, getting the certs, getting the job, and then keeping up to date on the IT world. From CompTIA, those are the A+ and the Security Plus and all those certificates, to Cisco, the MCSE, to EC Council, the Certified Ethical Hacker, to VMware, IT Pro TV has your team covered. Over 4,000 hours of really high-quality, binge-worthy, on-demand training in every possible category. Then they do more every day. They're live Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, engaging hosts. It's kind of like what we do, but it's all about IT. Courses are listed in the catalog, very easy to find, either by category, cert, job role. Of course, they've got search. You could stream their courses anywhere, live or on demand, whether it's on a Chromecast or the iOS or Android app or on Roku. They have a great app there, Amazon Fire TV. Their Apple TV app's superb. You can even stream, of course, on your PC. That means you could start on a big screen TV on a Roku at home, get in the car, stream on your Android device as you drive into work, put it in the corner on your screen as you're at work, and learn the whole time. And it's fun. If you're listening to Security Now, this stuff's perfect, right up your alley. You got a team? You'll love IT Pro TV's Pro Portal. You get complete control over your team's training schedule. You get all the metrics, logins, viewing time, courses viewed, tracks completed, and more. The corporate standard is $799 per user per year. That includes the official CompTIA video training. They've got that now. Live chat with hosts and other members, so if you've got questions. Download course video and audio. Watch it anywhere, even in the air. Career coach services and more. There's corporate premium. That's $999 per user per year. You get all of that plus practice tests, virtual labs, access to Dev Pro TV, Office Pro TV, Creative Pro TV, and Biz Pro TV. These guys have been busy. And then the enterprise is $1,249 per user per year. You get all the premium plus access to authorized IT project management content, service management content, governance content, and a dedicated success manager to help you keep that team on track. Now, that's for the businesses. If you're an individual and you're looking for a new career, IT Pro TV is the most flexible way to learn IT. You pass your certs, you accelerate your career, and we've got a 7-day trial of the individual monthly memberships waiting for you at itpro.tv/securitynow. itpro.tv/securitynow. And you can go there, too, to get the team demo and ask about their extended trials for teams. itpro.tv/securitynow. Do, when you buy, whether it's the corporate or the individual memberships, use the code SN30, SecurityNow, SN30, for 30% off as long as you stay active forever. That's amazing. That's itpro.tv/securitynow. Use the code SN30, 30% off all individual and team subscriptions. Wow. IT Pro TV, flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI proven. We've been with these guys practically since they started, and they are growing like crazy. They're just doing a great job. itpro.tv/securitynow, and again, the code is SN30. Okay, Steve, let's hear it. I got to know.
Okay, so first, what the idea being the minimum solution.
Yeah.
So first, what looks good but doesn't work. So imagine you designed a system with no WAN communication required for spending money from the smartphone. That sort of seems like what we were talking about. Remember, basically there was an app on which you could have where the app could hold the balance, and apparently it was a negotiation just between you and the vending machine. You selected what you wanted, and the vending machine communicated over Bluetooth or near field and got essentially deducted the money from the wallet that the app contained and said, enjoy your candy bar. And of course the app was reverse engineered. The guy was able to give himself 999 euros. And so, whoops, this wasn't very secure. So fixing that problem is not hard. What we saw was apparently a system where the phone wasn't connected to the internet, the vending machine wasn't connected to the internet, and that the sole communication link was between the phone and the vending machine. The problem was the wallet was not secured. So securing the wallet is trivial. We have well-established, simple, and inexpensive hardware which can protect a secret key from being disclosed, the so-called TPM, right, the Trusted Platform Module, which is a version of an HSM, a hardware security module. The idea being that, we didn't talk about like what is the attack surface. Do we want to protect the system from the vending machine itself being physically attacked? And you could argue that, well, if you're going to crack open the vending machine, you can take the candy bar so you don't have to buy it. But a larger attack would be to steal some cryptographic secrets, which would then allow you essentially to have the equivalent of attacking all the vending machines that shared that secret. But it's just not difficult to protect a secret. Our iPhones do it. Our motherboards that have a TPM chip do it. So, and it's no longer expensive. Those chips are, just on motherboards, and they're available for pennies. So let's assume we can keep a secret in the vending machine that is proof against attack. Well, that means that all of the vending machines could securely share that one secret, and that one secret, it doesn't need fancy public key crypto. It could be just a symmetric key. It's just a secret key which is either used to encrypt the wallet or to sign the wallet. But doing either of those things completely prevents the wallet from being tampered with. That is, it would completely defeat this attack where any reverse engineering of the app could in any way alter the wallet so that the alteration was not detected. If it was encrypted, the wallet would just be an opaque blob. It would just look like static that you couldn't do anything with. If it was signed, then you could see the contents, but you couldn't touch it. You couldn't alter them, or that would break the signature. And the point being that when the wallet was handed over Bluetooth or near field to the vending machine, it would just reject it. It would say, sorry. It would use its secret key to check the signature, and say something wrong with a wallet, you know, go deal with headquarters in order to get your wallet repaired and then come back if you want your candy bar. So that problem, that is this tampering with the wallet problem, is easy to fix. But it doesn't address the actual security. There's still a flaw here. And that is, there is in this model, there, even if you've made the wallet you've made it tamper proof, you haven't solved what is known as or could be known as the double spending problem. Because nothing would prevent an attacker from making a copy of the wallet before they buy the candy bar. They take the wallet, make a copy of it, right? Then they buy the candy bar. The vending machine deducts the cost of the candy bar, gives them back a re-signed wallet with a lower balance, and they simply replace the wallet that has now less money in it with the copy that they made before they bought the candy bar. They've essentially reset the wallet's balance, and the whole vending machine system would have no way of knowing that it happened. So you just buy another candy bar and do that forever. So while we address the first issue of wallet tampering, we haven't really solved the problem of creating a secure vending machine system. The existence of the double spending problem demonstrates that there is no means by which the user's balance can only be stored in the app, in this case, in the smartphone. That is, you absolutely have to somehow involve another party. You can't. There's just no way to prevent double spending if you can copy a wallet that has money in it and reset it after you've taken the money out. So if every vending machine did have a connection to the internet, and again, we don't know that that's the case. We're assuming it's not. But because if every vending machine was on the internet, then this sort of double spending could be trivially prevented by having the vending machine essentially reach around the user to contact headquarters, and the user's balance would actually be maintained by the vending machine operator, headquarters. And so, again, then any kind of fraud of this sort could be prevented. Essentially, the app would then be reduced to the role of identifying the user whose account and balance is maintained somewhere where the vending machine is able to access it and deduct the amount from the wallet there. But we're assuming this is not the case. That is, that the vending machines are being kept simple and they're not connected to the internet, which is why they were so easily hackable by this first generation attempt at an app. So let's assume the vending machines do not have a connection to the internet. All they have is a connection to the user who's standing in front of them with a nearby connection, with a Bluetooth or near field connection. If that's the case, we still need a third party, not the vending machine, not the user, but we need to get in contact with headquarters. And since we cannot trust the app, we have to use the app as an intermediary. It's the link between the vending machine and headquarters. So now we have a system that once again works securely. The user says, hey, I want a candy bar. So the vending machine prepares a transaction which it signs with its secure key. It's got to have that, because there has to be something that the app doesn't know, and that's the secret stored in secure hardware, in a trusted platform module chip for, you know, a few cents these days. So the transaction description is signed by the vending machine's network secret. I mean, it could be in all the same secret in all the vending machines. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. There's no need for a per vending machine secret. It could have one if it wanted it, but unnecessary. We're wanting to keep this simple. So it signs that with its secret and uses the Bluetooth or near field link to give it to the phone and say, if you want the candy bar, you got to check in with headquarters and give it this signed transaction. Again, the app can't mess with it, can't fuss with it, because it's a cryptographic signature. It could see it if it wasn't encrypted. It could be encrypted if they wanted the additional security. And when I was thinking this through, I was thinking, and you know, it's a vending machine, right? It's got like limited quantities of candy bars. So if it's going to be sending a packet to back to headquarters, it ought to send its current inventory along with it. So that way, headquarters can keep track of how many candy bars are in the machine and send someone out to refill the vending machine if it's getting dangerously low. But anyway, you know, extra feature. So the phone has this transaction. Oh, I forgot one part, very important. The vending machine also has a nonce. It generates a – it doesn't even have to be encrypted, really. It's just – it could just be a counter. Doesn't really matter because it doesn't have to be secret, but it absolutely has to have a nonce. That is a, as we know, that's short for number used once, at a token which it embeds in this transaction, and that's to prevent replay. Because what happens is this transaction is going to go to headquarters along with the user's ID who wants the candy bar. And so it uses the smartphone link. We know the smartphone is on the internet. Vending machine doesn't have to be. User smartphone is certainly on the internet. So it sends it to headquarters, who looks up the user, checks their balance, looks into the transaction, says, oh, candy bar, 25 cents. Deducts that from the balance, assuming that there is a balance there. Authenticates the transaction and resigns it with, again, this shared secret that headquarters and all the vending machines have. So this authenticated, approved, and resigned transaction, comes back to the phone. Of course, the user, just this all happens instantaneously from the user's perspective. The phone now uses its Bluetooth or near field link to send the approved transaction back to the vending machine that checks the signature. It can only have been their approval could only have been created by somebody that had the secret also. And it could be a different secret if you wanted to have multiple secrets. But again, no need. Keeping it simple. Checks with its secret, verifies it, and then turns on the motor that rotates the screw and drops the candy bar out for the purchaser to pick it up. At that time, the nonce which had been issued on the transaction which was pending is removed from an outstanding purchases list. Probably only one at a time, but if you might have two or three people buying things, I guess. So you might have multiple outstanding transactions, but you probably don't need them. But the point being that by having a nonce, which it is now deleted from its outstanding nonces list at the time that it accepted the approved transaction, even, you know, the app is no longer able to get to resubmit an approved transaction, because the nonce no longer will be accepted by the vending machine because it already issued a candy bar from an approved transaction with a nonce. So anyway, a nice little fun problem in crypto protocols and engineering, where we engineer a system where the vending machine's cost is kept low because all it has is a very inexpensive secret key, unhackable because it's in its hardware. It does not need to have the additional complexity and cost of its own connection to the internet, yet it's able to interact with a nearby user's phone, which does have an existing connection, transact through an app where the app is reduced to an intermediary that has no ability to alter anything happening. It can see it if it wants to, or it could be encrypted if there's some benefit. And as a little extra feature, we threw in the ability for the vending machine to continuously inform headquarters of how much stuff it has in its physical goods inventory, so that headquarters can dispatch someone out to refill the machine if it's getting dangerously low. And so our listeners can compare the system that I proposed with their own solutions and see if they had a better idea. I can't think of anything better than that.
So a couple of people did get that, though.
Cool.
No, you're saying. Cool. You don't know.
Oh no. Yes, there were some people who I saw. Certainly the gang that hangs over in crypto land at GRC, they were on the ball completely. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that seems like the obvious way to do it.
Yeah, there are, and that's what we've seen with this sort of stuff. Yeah. Is we've got some what I love about crypto is that they are simple little modular things like signatures and asymmetric or symmetric keys and hashes. And, some cool components that you get to assemble in different ways to usefully solve problems, but they're unhackable once you apply them correctly. And unfortunately, the reason we had this interesting little thought experiment is that, boy, the company that did it the first, gave it the first try really didn't put much time into it, apparently, because – yeah, they had a very insecure and very easily hackable solution.
A friend of mine runs ice cream vending machines. Is his business, and the way they know when it's time to refill, they have a little scale in the freezer, and they know the weight of the machine.
Clever.
And, that's sent back to the home office. And, of course, you might say, well, then how do they know which ones to bring? Well, the truck always has all of the stuff. And there are certain pretty predictable patterns as to which ice creams sell faster than others. Yeah, it's got one of those. If you see it, if you go to a convenience store and see those, they're like, I think it's Hershey's freezers there with the ice cream treats in there.
Got
scales on the bottom. So he knows when it's time. Send the guy out to refill.
Low tech but effective.
Yeah, yes. It works. He also bought all of the payphones from AT&T because it was too small a business for AT&T. This guy is a brilliant guy. It's too small a business for AT&T, but payphones are still widely used, especially in poorer communities. He retrofitted them with cell phones, and it's a good little business. It's a little cash cow. Yeah.
Nice.
Poor guy's got to roll those quarters, though. But other than that, it is time to wrap this up, as they say.
Donald.
Thank you. thank you so much, Steve Gibson. You'll find
Daffy.
Daffy. I don't know who it is. Oh, well. It's Elmer Fudd, actually. Steve is at grc.com. That's his website, grc.com. And that's where you'll find this show, 64 kilobit audio, plus human transcriptions, human written transcriptions.
And the recently blessed Spinrite, Leo.
And the recently blessed Spinrite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. Also lots of good free stuff, too. He's very good about that. GRC.com. He's at SGGRC on the Twitter. That way, if you have something to tweet to him, you can do it. He even accepts direct messages from all sources. If you want video of the show, you can get that at our website. We have video and audio at twit.tv/SN of all the 687 episodes on record and a few that aren't on record. And you can also subscribe. Best thing to do really is get your podcast application to subscribe to Security Now so you don't miss a minute and you will have it all forever. My friend, we have wrapped this thing up.
We have come to the end of another podcast. until this time next week. Oh, my goodness. And that's Election Day in the U.S.
Oh,
so
I want to see that I voted sticker on every single
that's
person.
That's a biggie. 100%. Yep. I'll be proudly wearing mine.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time.
Okay, my friend. Bye.
Security Now.